It's time for Gervie's Law, the intersection of law and life with your host, Alan Gervie. Alan is the managing attorney at the law firm of Rowan, Gervie & Wynn, a workers' compensation law firm which has represented injured workers for over 35 years. And now, here's your host, Alan Gervie.
Good evening. I am Alan Gervie. And this is Gervie's Law. I'm just so excited that I got here today because we have a great guest. And I've been driving for the last hour and a half from Ontario. And for those of you who don't know, because I know a lot of people around the country listen to the show and in Canada, I'm not talking about Ontario, Canada, although I will be in Ontario, Canada later this week. But I was in Ontario, California, and it's interesting because our guest does have some interest in Ontario, probably spent some summers up in the Canadian beautiful lake area, but I digress. So my daughter, Harper, who you've heard about quite a bit, has a softball tournament today. We had three games in Ontario, and my voice is a little raspy because a lot of yelling, and we lost all three games by a lot of runs in each game. And I don't know what to say on the drive back, and my daughter was trying to get to a birthday party, which she did make it to, thankfully, because the day wasn't a total loss. But it's interesting as a parent because you don't want to be hard on the kids, but at the same time, you know, you want them to realize that it's still fun. Even if you're losing, you can learn from losing. And my guest today hasn't done a lot of losing, although she may tell us differently. When you are an attorney for, I don't want to say how many years, because she looks like she's been an attorney for 10 years, but it's probably closer to 30. And you've had so many cases, and you become the go-to criminal lawyer in Hollywood, and one of the top women attorneys in this country. And maybe I can say that she's also an expert in damage control and crisis management. And I don't know if that's usually associated with being a lawyer, but we'll hear more about that. She's not in the media a lot. In fact, I think she usually ignores TMZ when they come up to her. And I've seen some of the videos where she gets into the elevator. I'm not sure if she's at her home or at the office. And she doesn't say anything to them. And I give her credit for that because too many attorneys open their mouth. And she has represented a who's who of Hollywood stars. I don't even know where to start. And she can stop me if I say someone who she wasn't a client, because rarely, but sometimes I do name clients and one of my guests will say, well, they weren't really a client. They kind of just came and talked to me, but I didn't represent them. So we could start with Leonardo DiCaprio, Harvey Weinstein. There, that's someone who had a few media lines over the years. So Harvey Weinstein, Britney Spears, Kiefer Sutherland, Mel Gibson, Lindsay Lohan, Selma Blair, Kanye West, Pee Wee Herman, Heather Locklear, Cameron Diaz, Caitlyn Jenner, Sylvester Stallone, Reese Witherspoon. Do I have your attention yet, listeners? I think I do. Johnny Depp. I haven't said anyone that you haven't represented, have I?
I'll invoke my Fifth Amendment right against self-incrimination on that.
I appreciate that, and this would be the place to invoke that. Darren Sharper, I am a Vikings fan. I used to be a Darren Sharper fan, so for those of you who don't know about that case, maybe we'll talk about it. There's so many. Prince Andrew, did they really call you the Rottweiler?
I can officially say no one has ever called me the Rottweiler. I don't know how the British tabloids picked that up or invented it, but it was incredibly fun to hear that someone was calling me a dog.
Well, you're certainly not a dog. And I think the key words you said, and I haven't even introduced Blair Burke yet, but she's already giving us some inside information that maybe the British tabloids just aren't that credible. Just maybe. You know, if they don't call you the Rottweiler and they say they are, maybe they just created it. So we are privileged to have with us Blair Burke. She has been incredible for so many people, so many years. Harvard Law, both her parents were lawyers, That has to be something, and well known to your father, well known criminal lawyer in North Carolina, Blair. First of all, welcome to Gervie's Law.
Thank you, Alan, and it's a pleasure to be here.
And thank you for coming. And I know that maybe Laura Wasser pushed you a little bit, and we love Laura Wasser, but here she is in studio. And let me just ask you, Blair, to start off with, because I did mention about your lawyers, your parents being lawyers, your father doing a bang up job as a criminal attorney, your mother working for University of North Carolina.
Yes, she. Both my parents are exceptional people. And my mother, when I was 12, she had been a social worker and went back to law school, went to night
Wow.
school, became a lawyer, ended up being the founder of one of the first student legal services programs in the country, worked for decades, deeply respected in our community and a wonderful role model. And my dad had been, we grew up, they had met at the University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill, and
right.
stayed. I grew up in Chapel Hill, a beautiful, wonderful childhood. And
very different from Hollywood, California.
A little different from Hollywood, yeah, just a tad. And
a tad
watched my father, who had been the city prosecutor, and then went into private practice as a criminal defense lawyer, and watched closely what he did and the lives he affected and changed and helped.
How did they impact you? Because you're talking about this almost like, they are in the new, a newspaper ad. Here it is. Here's my dad. Here's my mom. But when you were growing up with them, what was that like? Were they always talking about law? Did they push you into law, or is this something that you just came up on your own?
They never pushed. They wanted me to be a musician.
Really?
But we had a dinner table that was Socratic.
Yeah.
And I watched as particularly my father helped everybody from the sheriff to the, a poor county family. And I watched what he did and what he cared about. And it didn't always matter if anybody had the resources to hire him. He helped people in trouble, and he cared about what he did, and he cared about the clients. And, I will never forget, I had a childhood where a farmer would... We were a Jewish family, but once a year he'd bring a live pig to my house.
Really?
To thank my dad, or, the head of the local Hell's Angels, who would show up with a Christmas gift and a Nancy and Ronald Reagan paperweight from the Hell's Angels. So it was a very personal practice he had, and he took it very seriously, and he had wonderful relationships with the prosecutors, with the judges, with the community itself. And I watched how much integrity he had and how much care he gave to his practice. And it really was inspiring. And I could never conceive of doing anything else, frankly.
It's interesting because I was reading some comments about you, and someone said about Blair Burke that your ego is always under control. Do you attribute that to what you saw, in particularly in your dad, but in your parents, when you think about how you are giving back with a lot of pro bono work that you do, caring about people, and not getting caught up in the media, all of the hype and all of the ego that a lot of lawyers, believe me, and some who have been guests on the show, are driven by?
I think at the end of the day, I care about being an effective advocate and really representing my clients who I meet on the worst day of their lives, not the best day, and knowing that I can be a far more effective advocate if I am not paying attention to my own self-promotion
yeah.
and my own ego. And when it comes to media, when it comes particularly in this moment where you have the white hot attention and a 24/7 news cycle, particularly with the advent of social media and the power to accuse and change a life within minutes now.
Yeah.
You know, the traditional tropes about having press conferences and constantly opening your mouth about a case, in my experience, rarely serve the interests of my clients.
It's really interesting because, you know, we've dealt with it. I remember the first time Gloria Allred was on the show and I asked her, I said, does it bother you when people call you a media whore? And her answer, I thought, was an effective answer. She said, I don't care what they call me because I'm speaking for those who don't have a voice for themselves. But, you know, what you say, and tell me if this quote is accurate, says that the media lawyers that you see are cringeworthy. They're cringe-inducing. Why are they cringe-inducing other than the fact that they may be putting themselves before their client?
Well, you know, self-promotion can be a dangerous thing for lawyers. And when you advance your own interests over those of your client, I don't think there's rarely justification for that. It's one thing if you're a policy advocate, if you are appearing for a policy issue. And I have, you know, in the few instances where I've done a good amount of media, it's been for a criminal justice issue. But as a criminal defense lawyer, when I speak about one of my clients, what comes first is a republication of the allegation,
right,
of the worst of it, not the best of it. And I think rarely does the public care much for what the lawyer is talking about. So I'm careful about that. And I think I hope it's to the advantage of my clients.
Well, I think you're confident that it is. After all these years, you've seen the success that you've had without having to go to the media. And, you know, we're watching the Johnny Depp trial now, and we can talk about Johnny Depp after the break if you like. But clearly people are seeing a different side of him, Amber Heard. All of this is something that if it's behind closed doors or people aren't as aware of it, maybe it's not going to harm their reputations like what you're doing is trying to control that kind of potential harm.
I think that's very insightful. And I think there are times where it's to the advantage of someone where there's a misimpression or misinformation out there to be seen and heard. Just in a criminal case, it's rarely that priority because of the power to accuse and the power of accusation, and the republication of that accusation rarely helps the person you're representing.
And in this day and age with social media, it just gets out of control. I know that a lot of the public that knows things about celebrities, it's just from the media and probably not always for the best. We're going to talk more to Blair Burke after the break. You're listening to Gervie's Law right here on Talk Radio 790 KABC.
You're listening to Gervie's Law, the intersection of law and life on AM 790 KABC.
Yes, we're back. I'm Alan Gervie, and we're talking to Blair Burke. And it's funny because I listed off some of her clients, and a lot of people maybe didn't realize that some of these people were in trouble. When you talk about, you know, Kiefer Sutherland and Lindsay Lohan, maybe we know about that, Reese Witherspoon, Cameron Diaz. Blair, it seems like there's just a fascination with Hollywood putting these people into the spotlight, into the media, trying to exploit whatever situation. A lot of them have to do with paparazzi or some others. Nothing that we would consider to be horrible, but they get put into the media and it explodes, gets put out of proportion. How do you do this, what I called earlier damage control? When you take on a client, a high-profile client, a Hollywood well-known A-lister, aren't you just frustrated by looking at the facts and thinking, why is this exploitation occurring?
I think it's human nature. You know, there's a great German expression, Schadenfreude, where we build someone up in society only to knock them down. And to have a perverse pleasure in watching it happen sometimes. And one thing being in this town for the last, I can't even believe it, 25, 30 years,
right.
Is that, you know, we have a company town in a lot of ways, but it's the film business or the television business or the music business, and not if we were in Detroit, the car business or...
it's a little more interesting in Hollywood than the car business.
Maybe. Except maybe Elon.
That's true.
But
that's entertainment business too.
But you know, what you see is that, people have real lives, even if they're famous, even if they are considered a celebrity, and sometimes they'll have a bad day.
Yeah.
Just like anyone, they shouldn't be defined for the rest of their careers or their lives by that one bad day. So a lot of what I do, frankly, is pre-charging, you know, where someone's accused of something. They may have a high profile, but I get into the case and believe strongly that it's not just that they are charged with a crime, even though they may have been accused of a crime. And I also am cognizant of the fact that once they're in the system, it's very hard, even if I can get the charge thrown out, for anybody to believe that they were actually factually innocent.
Right.
So, that
the charge was not that big a deal.
Right. And not be overcharged, which is a problem in our criminal justice system.
Yeah.
Sometimes people will make a mistake, but the government will then accuse them of something that they haven't done, far more serious. You know, many of my clients have the resources to hire an attorney. That's not true in our society for a lot of folks. And a lot of folks don't realize that, you know, if you have a public defender, the first time they can meet you or do anything in your case is once you're charged. But if an attorney can get in at an early stage of a case, say after an incident, for instance, a football player who's arrested on an airplane, there's a disturbance in the first class section, and he's arrested for domestic violence. And it's all just a bunch of verbal altercation. And, you know, with some investigation and presentation to the authorities, you have a chance at getting that person not charged at all. The stakes in that case can be enormous.
Yeah.
And if that person were poor or indigent, they wouldn't have an advocate until they'd already been charged with a crime. And that makes for a big difference
for
someone.
Sure. Now, you said in celebrity-obsessed culture, we lose sight of how human we all are and how vulnerable we are when we are in crisis. Have you found that to be true with some of your well-known celebrity clients? Or do they treat you differently? When you talk about vulnerability in that quote, is it the same as some of these other people you're talking about, the layperson, if you will?
I will say this. In more than 25 years of practice, I have maybe fired all of two clients. And, you know, one of the things when you have to hire a criminal defense attorney, it's a terrifying situation. I don't care if you're the CEO of a Fortune 100 company or a movie star or, you know, stay-at-home dad from the Valley.
Right.
It is terrifying and I think humbling in many ways. And I think the less contact you've had with the criminal justice system, many of my clients have never been accused of anything before. It can be a daunting prospect to be going through the system. And I think there's no room for entourage or pretense. And I also am a big believer in client control. You know, if someone wants me to help them, they're in my office sitting in front of me at my desk. There's no agent or manager or anyone in between because it's critical for me to be able to help them that we are looking each other in the eye and they understand that I'm there as their advocate.
And somehow inside, they are certainly confident in what you can do because maybe it's not their expertise or their forte. Now, I know CeeLo Green said, you're the best lawyer. The quote was, she's the best lawyer in LA. And when he went into court, he said, I have nothing to worry about. How are you able, you can use CeeLo as an example or someone else, how are you able to get them to feel so confident that you're going to take care of business as soon as necessary, like in court?
Well, CeeLo is a lovely guy, but it has to do with trust, I think. And it has to do with being willing to work hard, too. I think not over-promising people is critical. I think telling them the truth about their situation and showing them that you're willing to roll your sleeves up and really work as their advocate makes a difference.
Yeah.
And I think in that process, involving your clients in their own cases, because in my experience, my ability to successfully represent a client has a lot to do with how hard they're pedaling as well. They're not checked out. They're a part of this, and they are there to help me help them.
Do you think the fact that you represented Mel Gibson and you're Jewish and there was some anti-Semitic issues relating to his arrest, does that prove in and of itself that he isn't anti-Semitic and he may have just been an alcoholic or drinking? Like, how are you able to actually represent someone who maybe you feel is not someone you want to represent?
Well, I believe strongly that I'm not a bus, you know. People who come to me for help, I decide whether I'm going to be their lawyer or not, and they also decide if I'm going to be their lawyer. But I also believe in the Constitution, and I don't believe that my clients are my friends necessarily, and I don't believe that their opinions necessarily dictate whether I represent them. In that case, the irony was I got hit from both sides.
Yeah.
Both people who didn't know I was Jewish, who were critical of my choice in representing him, and people who did know I was Jewish and felt like I'd somehow abandoned my tribe somehow. But I will say this, that's a perfect example. I am a criminal defense attorney. I'm representing somebody accused of a crime. I'm not representing somebody for their beliefs. I do a lot of work representing men accused of sexual assault.
And we can talk about Harvey Weinstein after
well,
the parade.
Maybe not Harvey, but we can talk about representing people accused of sexual assault.
Right.
That doesn't mean I endorse sexual assault or endorse people who've committed crimes. It's really my duty as a criminal defense attorney to make the government, the state, prove their case and prove it beyond a reasonable doubt and defend the accused.
And you call yourself a feminist as well.
I very much think of myself as a feminist.
We're going to talk a little bit about that after the break. Interesting stuff. Appreciate your candor. You're listening to Gervie's Law right here on Talk Radio 790 KBC.
Hitchhiked away across USA, plucked her eyebrows
yeah.
on the way, shaved her legs, and then he was
not
she,
sure
says, hey,
this
babe.
Has to do
take
with
a walk on the wild side.
Criminal allegations.
Said, hey, honey,
but it's cool. Thank you, Wayman. Take a walk on the wild side. Yeah, a lot of these people are taking a walk on the wild side. We're talking to Blair Burke. CNN said you vaporize a celebrity's sticky legal situation before it goes viral. And earlier in the show, I was talking about some of your noteworthy clients. People may not have known about allegations. And that's what it talks about when CNN says that you're vaporizing a celebrity sticky situation before it goes viral. Is that something that you consciously are aware of? When someone comes into your office, let's say, and I'll just off the list, let's say Leonardo DiCaprio or, you know, Cameron Diaz, Caitlyn Jenner, Johnny Depp, they walk into your office. Is that the first and foremost thing on your mind to try to keep this quiet and get things resolved before it goes viral?
I think absolutely it's a priority. We live in a moment, in a culture that much of the media sells tickets to these kinds of allegations and problems and criminal cases. And it's very hard to get your reputation back once that ship has sailed. And if I can use my skills to avoid the public even knowing about the issue, knowing about the accusation, and, you know, establish truthfully to prosecutors that there is not a case that they should bring, I think I do far more for my client than right. letting them get charged, having a media maelstrom, and then riding in on a white horse to get the charge dismissed or a jury to acquit. If I can avoid in the first instance them ever being publicly accused.
You know, that's such an important point. Another quote about you is, she's always had a keen understanding that her own self-promotion doesn't do any of her clients any good. And I think that's what you're coming from. And that's maybe where your roots are, growing up in North Carolina, focusing on the person, actually listening to them and not taking this as an opportunity to put yourself out in the media spotlight. One of your colleagues said, Blair Burke is one of those people who instantly impresses. She is brilliant. She's an extraordinary communicator, authoritative and persuasive, but she also is patient and inquisitive listener. What did he mean when he said you're patient and an inquisitive listener, if you know?
Well, whoever that was lying for that whole first part. But I do believe in listening. Often the key to a defense in a case is by carefully listening, both listening to the government's evidence, both listening to my client, not taking anything as necessarily true or false, but critically listening. And I think that can be of enormous benefit in the adversarial process, in the system we have, in helping somebody with a criminal matter. And I am always trying to be a better listener and always can be a better listener.
You know, it's so important because a lot of times when I'm preparing one of my clients for a deposition, I tell them this is a listening exercise. It's not a talking exercise because they come out and they just want to talk and they want to tell their story. And in doing so, they're not listening to what the questions are. How do you get that across to younger attorneys, maybe who haven't had the experience that you have, that being a good listener may be the key to actually being successful with your client?
You know, I think experience. I think the more I can expose a younger lawyer to the courtroom, to the interaction with a client, to the investigative stage of a case and understanding what that means, critically looking at evidence, critically looking at the accusations and the witness statements, that gives them the exposure to listening and how you do it the right way.
Yeah, it's almost leading by example.
In many ways it is, I would hope, and doing it with integrity. You know, it's a myth in the system that, you know, that the best advocacy is this, you know, constant warfare and screaming and yelling and the prosecutors are your enemies. And,
right.
you know, I think prosecutors can be the most important advocates in the system if they're ethical and truthful.
And you have a good relationship with them.
I hope so.
You don't want to piss them off.
I don't think you ever needlessly do that at all. There's sometimes I don't mind upsetting a prosecutor.
You can say pissing off a prosecutor.
I think, you know, if they don't act ethically, if they don't act in a professional way in doing their job, I think there's no problem getting on the other side of
right.
them. But
that's not for you. That's for your client. You're doing it because you're representing your client, not because you're trying to get the better of someone.
I think that's exactly right, Alan. I think you really, even in the toughest times, you want to keep focused on the interest of the client. And when you get ruffled yeah. and upset and in a sort of battle of egos, it's really easy to lose sight that what you're really there for is the interest and protection of the client.
There's so many lessons that people can take from this conversation. When you look back over the last 25, 30 years, what are you most proud of?
You know, I would say that in many ways, I'm most proud of the pro bono work I've been able to do, which is a luxury because most of my clients have the resources to hire me. But I really have felt strongly over the years of having a portion of my practice dedicated to pro bono work. And those cases, you know, one of my first cases as a young attorney was representing a man named Clarence Chance, who had spent 17 and a half years in state prison in California for the murder of a deputy sheriff here in Los Angeles that he had not committed.
Wow.
And my partner, who was then my boss and brought me into the firm as a young lawyer, Barry Tarlow, who was an extraordinary lawyer, had agreed to take on the habeas appeal of that case. And over the course of 2 years, we worked like hell to prove that Clarence was innocent and wrongfully convicted. And watching him come out of prison, a free man, and actually having a life after that,
wow.
all his formative years had been in prison for a crime he hadn't committed. And that goes all the way to a couple of years ago, I represented a young man who's now free today, who was accused of murder as a 16-year-old. And the district attorney's office tried to try him as an adult, and we took on his case, and we were able to get him sent back to the juvenile system, and he amazingly survived being in custody.
Wow.
And actually, while he was in custody, was the first young man or young woman in the entire history of the juvenile system here in Los Angeles County to get his college degree.
That's amazing.
And he is now doing so well and has a future and would not have been able to afford an attorney.
You know, I want to talk a little bit about that after the break when we talk about the work you've done with juveniles and how you've focused on representing them in your pro bono work. But I want to get back to the Chance case. Now, did that happen before or after the Ozzy Osbourne case? Because the Ozzy Osbourne case was one that really kind of lifted you into the limelight. When were you doing work like you're talking about back then, when you did the Ozzy Osbourne case?
That was after
yeah.
the Ozzy's case. But again, you know, we talk about mentoring and setting example. My partner, my supervising partner at the time, believed that there were a lot of injustices in the system because of a lack of resources, and believed strongly that even though we had a wonderful practice in criminal law, that we had an obligation to also represent people who did not have those resources. So I think they're on parallel tracks.
And that was right from the beginning.
Right from the beginning. Right from the beginning. And again, it taught me how to be a lawyer, taught me what was important, and that I could have an effect, that I could see change in the system by using my own advocacy and skills. And it was taught to me as a responsibility, not, you know, something to take for granted.
Do you ever feel like some of those cases of people who may not be well known or known at all are something you want to focus on more than some of the celebrity cases? Because I know the celebrities are coming to you whenever something happens. You know, it's not like you're advertising. You're not on the radio. You're not in TV. They know who to go to when they need some damage control or they need you to represent them on a criminal accusation. Do you sometimes feel like, oh my God, I got to deal with this prima donna? Why can't I just deal with someone who really needs my expertise?
You know, I actually don't think that. Many of those cases are some of my most interesting cases, and I don't represent prima donnas, so they won't be my clients. And
do you turn people away?
I do. I
really?
Do. Yeah, I do. And I believe strongly I can't be an effective advocate unless I want to represent you and your matter. And it really has nothing to do with whether you're famous or not. And it really has to do with your case and the level of interest in your case, and also whether I'm going to be able to make the decisions in the case and, effectively represent the person.
It's really interesting because a lot of people are under, obviously, the misinformation that someone comes to, you're taking the case, you're going to be out there and you're looking forward to it. But for you to be an effective advocate, like you say, you need to believe in it. You need to believe in the law behind it, defend the Constitution. And you don't really need to take on a case just because someone's famous.
I think it doesn't help the person that's accused if you don't have that commitment to the case.
Yeah.
And it's certainly not a situation where I would ever take a case because a person was in my favorite movie or was my, you know, I liked their music.
And you're not starstruck.
You know, for whatever reason, that's never been an issue.
Has there been anyone that you've kind of like taken a pause and say, oh my God?
Sure, but I'm a political junkie, so it's much more elected leaders who I've helped in the past that I
it wasn't Paul,
a little more struck.
Not Paul Rubens.
I love Paul Rubens. I think Paul Rubens is fantastic and a wonderful man, but no.
All right, we got to take a quick break. I almost got it out of her, but, you know, politicians, yeah, sometimes you just take a step back and you say, wow, these actors, we've seen so many of them. And just what's another one? You're listening to Gervie's Law. We're on Talk Radio 790 KBC. We got one more segment with the criminal lawyer for the stars, Blair Burke. And I didn't... I get this connection. This is an easy one. Smooth Criminal. Yeah, we're talking to Blair Burke, Harlow and Burke. How big is your firm, by the way?
There are, we're very small. There are five of us.
That's it.
That's it.
That's amazing. You know, it's interesting. Your friend Laura Wasser once told me, it takes a village. She says, I don't like to take all of the accolades, you know. I'm just representing my client, but we got so many people working for us that are doing a lot of the work that I don't have time to do, and I really appreciate that. Is that the same with you, or you can make it go with five people?
No, well, we're not a civil lawyer like Laura,
right.
So you know we're a smaller shop in the criminal practice. But you know everybody's critical on the team, that's for sure, and it certainly takes a village.
Yeah,
to mount a really strong defense and
you
properly
can't do it all yourself.
You can't do it all yourself.
You have a family.
I do have a wonderful husband and a wonderful daughter, and yes.
And you have other outside interests. You like to travel and do things.
We do.
You can't just be focused all the time on your practice.
I think my family would say otherwise, but, you know, a criminal defense lawyer doesn't really keep banker's hours. You know, yeah. Trouble comes up after 6 at night and on the weekends. And I think it helped that I grew up with that and understand that. And, you know, in some respects, it's a little bit about like being a doctor or a surgeon. You get calls late
You're
at night
call.
And you have to act quickly.
Yeah.
So
what issues, Blair, are important to you now in the criminal law arena that you're seeing, that you're interested in? And we'll talk a little bit about the juvenile pro bono work. But other than that, what are some of the issues that are important to you?
You know, it's important for me that the public understand and appreciate how important it is that we have the system we have where someone accused of a crime is properly and enthusiastically represented, no matter what they're accused of, and how important that is to our system, that no matter how horrific we believe the crime to be or the accusation made to be, that before we have a mob go and string the person up and take care of business, that there's somebody on their behalf standing up saying, hey, wait a minute. Let's make sure this is a righteous allegation. Let's Right. make sure that the government has evidence to prove that this person did this. Let's don't just decide because of a social media post that it must be true. And I think it's sometimes we lose sight of how important that is, that we reserve judgment and we wait and see what the evidence actually is before we take away somebody's liberty and put them in a cage.
Now, you've done a lot of work, pro bono work, primarily representing juveniles accused of serious crimes. It seems to me that that's an important issue, too, and a lot of these juveniles may not have someone like you of top quality to look at the issues and make sure that they're not getting railroaded. What's wrong with the juvenile system today, and why are you so involved in helping?
Well, that's a complicated question. You know, I think that a lot of folks don't realize that juveniles who are accused of crimes can end up losing their liberty, going to effectively prison. We have a system where we don't always assign the most experienced prosecutors or defense lawyers to prosecuting or defending juvenile cases. We
Right.
certainly don't give the resources that we should. And in my experience, that first contact with the criminal justice system that a child or a teenager has, how they are treated in the system, no matter what they may or may not have done, can affect the rest of their lives and be the difference in whether that person can be a contributing member of society in the future or just in a revolving door, starting with juvenile detention and ending up in state prison.
Right.
And not giving up on those young people, giving them a shot at either being properly defended and released from the system, or if they are responsible for wrongdoing, given the treatment, the rehabilitation that they should have to become a contributing member of society is critical.
Right.
And yet, when I first encountered the juvenile justice system, I just saw the fewest resources being committed to those cases, the most inexperienced prosecutors being assigned to those courts. And, you know, even to this day, we have something called DJJ, which is effectively a state prison for juveniles, that is one of the most decrepit facilities, there are a couple of them in the state, and, you know, the juveniles have constant problems with violence, being beaten both by fellow inmates and sometimes staff. They don't even have right now nutritional meals.
Right.
So, you know, that's separate and apart from lack of education, counseling, psychological counseling, training to come back into society. if we really want to do something to affect the future and lower the numbers of recidivists in our communities, we start there. And and we really should be prioritizing what we're doing with those young people. And I do care about it.
And I commend you for that, because you talk about turning lives around. That's the time to turn someone's life around, not when it's too late.
It's literally the moment.
The moment, and hopefully you can continue to have an impact. We only have 2 minutes left. Quickly tell us about the future for Blair Burke. What are your goals and your aspirations? It's like a job interview.
I love it.
In a minute
or less. I hope I get it.
I think you got it, believe me.
Because I really love being a criminal defense lawyer, and I would be very happy doing it for the rest of my time. I feel very lucky that I have found something I truly love to do. I appreciate how special that is, to really have a vocation
right.
that I get great pleasure from.
Has anyone come up to you and wanted to do a book with you or make a movie?
Well, we live in that town, right?
I know that. That's why I asked.
And I've had a number of occasions to politely say no.
And you will continue to do so?
I think so, yeah.
Because your values are right on. Their priorities are helping people and putting it about them, not about you.
Well, that's very generous of you to say, Alan, but it's selfish too.
I understand.
I really can't express.
And Even Mother Teresa was selfish.
Exactly. I say this to young lawyers, but it is a wonderful area of practice, and it is a gift to be able to truly help somebody.
Blair Burke, thank you so much for being a guest on Gervie's Law today. I've really enjoyed it.
Me as well, Alan. Thank you.
Thanks. Thank you for listening to another episode of Gervie's Law. We look forward. I think next week we have Greg Brady from the Brady Bunch. Barry Williams is joining us. So stay tuned. Have a great week.
This show was furnished by Rowan, Gervie, and Wynn.